old, he said. He looked shorter and older than she'd pictured him. Of course, the photographs she had were outdated, and she'd been a baby when her father had severed his connection to Haven. She felt a surge of hatred so strong it scared her. It was a hand from the dark side of the universe that reached up to turn her inside out. You've seen plenty of me, she said, but heard her voice as if it was a stranger's. Four, by my account. Looks can be deceiving, believe me. There is only one Gemma Ives. He smiled again at this, patient, indulgent, very slightly embarrassed. Sorry about the confusion. These little mix-ups do happen.
Your parents, I'm sure, would agree.
Dr. Saperstein. The woman in the suit began to speak, but he cut her off.
Later.
For a split second she saw, from beneath the surface of his expression, something sharp and mean solidify. It was like the sudden vision of a very sharp tooth. But almost instantly it was gone. He smiled at Gemma again and opened a door that led to a small and very ordinary-looking office.
Why don't you have a seat inside? I'm going to grab a soda.
You want a soda or something to eat? Gemma shook her head, although she was desperately thirsty and weak with hunger, too. But she didn't want to take anything Dr. Saperstein offered.
Go on. Make yourself comfortable. I'll be right with you.
When she didn't move, he hitched his smile a little wider. She could actually see the effort, watch individual muscles straining to achieve the right look.
Go on. It's all right.
No, she said. She wanted to scream. She wished she could open her mouth and let her rage come up like a sickness. It's not. It's definitely not all right.
Well, that's what we're going to try and sort out.
He spread his hands, as if she were the one who'd screwed up and now refused to admit it.
Look, I highly doubt you want to stay here, right? So go on and have a seat, and I'll be with you as soon as I can scare up some caffeine.
Lyra, 13. In the morning, they showered together, soapy, touching each other with slick fish fingers, filled with the joy of the new. They packed their few belongings, and Lyra took a pen from the nightstand. She left behind the Bible she found there. She associated it too much with Nurse Don't Even Think About It, with quick and blinding side swipes to the head. They had better luck than the day before. The desk clerk didn't even blink when they asked for directions to UPenn. She just slid a paper map across the desk and charted the best route with a little ink line. It's a hike, though, she said. You might want to Uber. Lyra just thanked her and said a quick goodbye. It was a hike, an hour of slogging next to a sluggish gray river and a grid of barely flowing traffic. Lyra marveled at the look of the houses on the river, enormous and colorful in a style she had never seen before. Selim puzzled over the map, charting their progress carefully, inching a finger along the ink pathway when Lyra read out the names of the streets they were passing. Finally, when his finger was almost directly above the little star indicating they had arrived, Lyra saw something that took her breath away. A group of boys and girls came toward her singing. There were so many of them that Lyra and Selim had to step off the sidewalk to avoid being bumped. Selim, she said and pointed. Several of them wore T-shirts marked with a logo she recognized. An electric thrill traveled her whole body. The University of Pennsylvania. Lyra knew it. Selim knew it. Everyone at Haven knew it. It was a place both Dr. Haven and Dr. Saperstein had come from. The bust in the entryway of admin wore a blanket bearing the same logo for a cape. On certain days, certain game days, God went into his office and didn't come out. Sometimes the staff members drank beer on those days, carted from the mainland in coolers on the boats and sat for longer than usual in front of the TVs, watching sporting events whose rules Lyra didn't understand. UPenn, she said out loud and began to laugh as the group of strangers raised their fists and shouted, Go Quakers! Finally she understood. UPenn meant the University of Pennsylvania, where both of the gods of Haven had started. where the second god, Dr. Saperstein, was soon due to return, and where she and Selim would be waiting for him. She'd assumed that U-Penn was a single place, almost like Haven, that had produced both Richard Haven and Dr. Saperstein, but once again the outside world smashed itself into 1,000 different visions, into dozens of buildings, hundreds of people, noise and color and rhythms she didn't understand. Kids sat cross-legged with homemade signs in front of the looming stone buildings, chanting. Others, ignoring them, lay out on blankets in the grass or played a game that involved a flat plastic disc and lots of running. "I don't understand where they all come from," Selim said, and she knew exactly what he meant. How could all these people have been made if not on purpose? "Come on," she said, and took his hand. Selim was agitated by the crowds. She remembered suddenly seeing an eclipse when she was younger, how the nurses had let them file out into the garden to look. Selim became like that when he was nervous, like something dark that swallowed the light around him. Lyra was anxious, too. The swell of voices from every direction made her head hurt. The blur of colors reminded her of the starbursts that crowded her vision when, stretched out on the examination table, she looked too long at the ceiling lights. If Dr. Saperstein was here, did that mean that other people from Haven were here, too? Guards with guns? People like the ones who had killed Jake Witz and had come most recently for Rick Harless? To her surprise, the first person they approached didn't hesitate when they asked whether she knew where to find Dr. Saperstein. "He's not coming," the girl said. She was wearing lots of rings and violet eyeshadow that made Lyra think of Reyna, and of the strange party where people stood in the half-dark together and also somehow alone, like the individual patches of land submerged in the marshes that only from a distance looked like solid ground. "I mean, they haven't officially announced it yet, but he won't." Lyra's palms began to sweat. "What do you mean?" she said, and repeated as faithfully as possible what she had overheard. "He was supposed to be here Tuesday for the ribbon cutting." "Yeah, but that's probably not happening either. Have you been to the protests? There's like 2,000 people outside." "Where?" Selim asked. "Over by the Haven Center, or whatever they're calling it now." The girl rolled her eyes. When she saw that Lyra and Selim had no idea what she was talking about, she sighed. "Next to the medical school and PCAM. You know where PCAM is, right? The Perlman Center for Advanced Medicine. It's right next to the Haven Center. You can't miss it. It's right on Civic Center. You students here or incoming?" Lyra said nothing. "Well, you'll get a real view of Penn anyway. Protesters and crusty alums and all. Whose side are you on?" She smiled in a way that might not have been friendly. "No one's side," Lyra said, though she had no idea what the girl meant. At the same time, Selim said, "Our own side," and squeezed Lyra's hand even tighter. They found PCAM and the medical school, an enormous modern complex, all steel and glass, which reminded Lyra of the real Haven, and next to it, the brand-new Richard C. Haven Center for Regenerative Research. "He was here," Lyra whispered excitedly. "The first god was here." It seemed impossible that God, the first god, could have existed here, so many hundreds of miles away from Spruce Island, that here, too, in this busy city, he'd put a thumb in the soft clay of reality. He'd existed. People knew his name. If there were a single place in the world where she would find help, it had to be here, where the gods of Haven would be once again reunited. Despite the crowd gathered in front of it, the building itself had the whistling, empty look of an abandoned shell. The revolving glass doors were roped off behind a thick red ribbon, and Lyra's heart picked up. This, then, must be the ribbon Dr. Saperstein was expected to cut. But the podium positioned directly in front of the doors stayed empty. The microphone crooked uselessly toward the open air like a finger beckoning to no one. Police sawhorses kept the crowd a safe distance from the building. Hundreds of people eddied around the steps, blocking the entrance. Lyra kept hold of Selim's hand. She wasn't sure she would have been able to loose herself he was squeezing so tight as they edged along the periphery of the crowd, puzzling over what it meant. From the fact that the girl with the violet eyeshadow had asked them whether they were students, she now knew this must be a school. Maybe this was simply how schools looked, how teaching took place. Many of the students carried signs that said, "Not our Penn, take Haven to hell, Penn students for awareness." Others waved school flags or carried signs that said, "Penn pride" or "Penn students for science." Between the two groups, there was obvious tension. A makeshift line divided them, like the finger of an invisible current had divided the crowd in two, and as they watched, two boys began pushing each other and one of them ended up on the ground, his glasses shattered. Finally, she worked up the courage to ask a girl what all the shouting was about. The girl, red-faced and sweaty, wearing mismatching shoes and thick glasses, was resting on a stone wall with a cardboard sign tucked between her legs. Because of the way it was angled, Lyra couldn't read what it said. "You go here?" She squinted at Lyra and Selim in turn, and when they shook their heads, seemed to relax. "Oh, I was gonna say, what planet are you from?" She bent down to retrieve her sign, propping it on the wall next to her. This one said, "Not our Penn." Lyra tried a different tack. "Do you know where to find Dr. Saperstein?" she asked. The sun was too bright. In its glow, she felt as if all her holes were visible, all the defects in her brain obvious. "Oh, the ceremony's off for sure. They're just too spine-cheesed to tell us. You heard about what happened in Florida, right? I mean, you're not actually from Mars." "Don't be a dick, Joe." This came from a boy sitting next to her. "Florida," Lyra swallowed. "You mean what happened at the Haven Institute?" The girl Joe nodded. "Richard Haven was a professor here like a million years ago. He's been dead for like a whole decade." She paused to let this settle in. "Anyway, he went off and made fuck you money doing biotech and who knows what, and he bought his name onto this building." "It wasn't biotech," the boy said. "It was pharmaceutical stuff." "No one knows what it was, and that's the point. No oversight. Typical 1% stuff, too big to fail. And Saperstein's just as bad." That she addressed to the boy, and he raised both hands. "Anyway," she turned back to Lyra and Selim, exhaling heavily so her bangs moved across her sticky forehead. "The Florida meltdown is like the worst environmental catastrophe ever." "Since the BP spill, at least," the boy chimed in. "Well, since the BP spill, for sure," Joe glared at him. "There are clouds of pollution, like seriously chemical clouds, practically poisoning everyone within 80 miles. "Not 80 miles, the boy put in mildly. "You're exaggerating." The girl didn't seem to hear him. She was getting worked up now. Her glasses kept slipping. Every few seconds, she thumbed them higher on her nose. "They're saying there might be generational damage. Plus, it turns out Saperstein was completely skirting federal regulations. They're saying he was cloning people." "One person is saying that." The boy interrupted her again and nudged her. "Didn't your mom ever tell you not to believe everything you read on the internet?" Finally, she turned on him. "Whose side are you on, anyway?" He shrugged and went quiet, picking at a pimple on his chin. "The point is," she said, rolling her eyes, "I'm pre-med, and I don't want this guy's name on our buildings. How about Marie Curie? How about a woman? Richard Haven doesn't represent me. Not my Penn." She pointed to her sign. "But where is Dr. Saperstein?" Lyra felt increasingly panicked. In the distance, she spotted a man uniformed in dark blue wearing mirrored sunglasses, a guard sent to collect her. Then he was gone, dissipated in the sweeping motions of the crowd, and afterward she wasn't sure whether she'd imagined him. Joe blinked at her. "I told you, he's not coming. He'll be lucky if he doesn't end up in jail." "Thank you." Lyra remembered just barely to say it. Thinking of Rick and the way he'd tried to teach her about manners and how to talk to people brought on an unexpected spasm of pain. They turned away from the girl and her sign. Then Selim pivoted suddenly. "He was making clones," Selim said. Both the girl and the boy stared. "I'm one of them," he said. "I'm number 72. "Ha ha," the girl said flatly. An ant was tracking across her sign. She frowned, took it up between two fingers, and squeezed. In the short time they'd been speaking to Joe, the crowd had grown even denser. Now the protests spilled up the steps, toppling the sawhorses, and as she watched, several students charged the podium and brought it crashing down. Lyra saw a blur of police uniforms among the crowd and felt suddenly as if she were going to faint. Reality slipped slowly toward darkness. "We have to get out of here." Selim sensed the change at the same time the current had tipped over to one of fury. The crowd seemed to pour into a single roiling mass, like a tight-knit cloud condensing on the horizon. "He still might come." "You heard them. He's not coming. He's not..." But Selim was whipped away from her when people surged suddenly between them, a wall of people pulsing together like an enormous organ, walls of breath and hair and sweaty skin. Someone grabbed Lyra's wrist, hard. She turned, and a scream throttled her, lodging somewhere in her throat. Though she had seen him only from a distance, in the harsh glare of the floodlight she recognized him. He was the same man who had come for Rick, but dressed up now like some kind of local security guard. But she would have sworn it was him. She recognized the flatness of his eyes like the dead stare of a fish. "Are you okay?" his mouth was saying, but she couldn't hear the words. Instead, she heard him laughing. She heard the guards on the marshes weeks and weeks ago laughing as they towed their way through the blood of dying replicas. "You know how expensive these things are to make?" She wrenched away from him. She spun around. She had a brief impression of open mouths and shouting, a boy with blazing eyes shouting at her. A backpack caught her in the chest, and she was knocked off balance. She was on the ground. Someone stepped on her fingers, sneakers and legs, so many bodies. She was momentarily overwhelmed. She couldn't breathe. Even as a girl reached to help her, the crowd moved. Suddenly, everyone was shouting, and she couldn't get up. Someone kneed her in the ribs. Through a rift in the crowd, she spotted Selim, flying at the guy with the backpack. A girl screamed. Selim was a sudden frenzy of motion. There were three guys fighting him now, and blood on his teeth. As she watched, trying to find the breath to shout, one of the boys caught him on the cheek, and then another one on the back of the head, and then a third kneed him in the stomach. Then he was on his knees, spitting up blood, but she couldn't get to him. Still, they were separated by a hard blade of moving bodies. Someone hooked Lyra by the elbows and got her to her feet. Air touched her lungs like a burn. She gasped and tears came to her eyes. "Are you okay?" the guy shouted. He was wearing glasses with only a single lens. She recognized him as the boy who'd gone down before, shoved by someone. He kept a hand on her arm, even as Selim finally pushed his way toward her. "Animals," the boy kept saying. "You're all animals." Now Lyra could see the guards carving the crowd up, dispersing it, but the man with the dead fish eyes was gone. Selim's face was swollen where he'd been hit. Lyra could tell how much pain he must be in. His cheek was cut. One of the guys who'd hit him must have been wearing a ring. "God damn! Tell me you aren't perspectives!" The boy in glasses looked furious. "Come with me. Let's get out of here before these psychopaths start a riot."
Gemma. 14. Dr. Saperstein returned with two cans of warm Diet Coke, even though she'd said she didn't want one. She didn't want to sit, and planned to say no, but at the last minute she was worried about her legs, which had begun to shake. So she sat, tucking her ankles together, pressing her hands between her thighs, hoping he wouldn't see how afraid she was. He poured his soda into a plastic cup, took a sip, and made a face.
"Why does the diet stuff always taste like the back of a spoon?"
He shook his head.
"The real stuff always goes first around here."
Gemma felt more confused than ever. Dr. Saperstein didn't look evil. She tried to paste what she knew about him onto his face, to make the images align. Emily Wong. Those photographs of the two of them together. Jake Witz and his father. Those hundreds and hundreds of starved and broken people he treated like possessions, disposed of by burning them in the middle of the ocean after drilling their bones or opening their skulls for marrow and tissue and cell samples. But she couldn't make it hang there. She couldn't make it fit. He leaned forward.
"I can't tell you how sorry I am that you're here," he said.
Shockingly, she believed him.
"I've been in Washington, D.C., crawling around on my knees trying to save this place."
"What? What is it? She had to swallow hard against the feeling that she would begin to cry. What are you doing with all of them here? He shook his head.
Nothing now, he said. I drove straight from D.C. this morning. Our funding's been cut.
This time his smile never traveled up past his lips.
20 years of research, 20 years of effort, incremental gains, mistakes and corrections. All of it,
he gestured, as if to scatter something into a passing wind. And what happens to them? Gemma said, through a hard fist in her throat. She was still too afraid to ask what she really wanted to know. What would happen to her? And to Pete? Dr. Saperstein took off his glasses to rub his eyes.
How much did your father tell you about Haven?
He didn't tell me anything, Gemma said. Dr. Saperstein looked surprised. But I know that you've been using the replicas to grow prions.
To study prions, he corrected her. You make them sound like petri dishes.
Isn't that what they are? The pressure in Gemma's chest was so great she felt as though she was speaking around a concrete block. It was all for the military, wasn't it? It was all to make weapons. He raised his eyebrows.
I won't ask how you know that, he said.
She could tell she'd impressed him and, weirdly, felt happy about it. Then she hated herself. Why did she care about impressing him?
Look, you obviously know quite a bit about Haven, but there's a lot you don't understand. The U.S. military gave us one of our biggest contracts, yes, but it wasn't our only one.
Then,
you know the word prion wasn't even coined until I was in college. It's been more than 30 years since then. But until I took over the Institute, we discovered almost nothing more about the way prions work, or how they progressed, or how fast.
The overhead light grayed the look of his skin.
Prion disorders share traits with some of the most crippling brain diseases we know. Diseases like Alzheimer's, which affects millions of people per year. Diseases we can't cure or even help.
I don't need a lecture, Gemma said. I asked what happens to the replicas now.
There are protocols, he said gently. I'm sure you understand that. Haven deals with, dealt with, deadly biomaterials. We're talking about a major health hazard.
Deadly biomaterials, otherwise known as replicas. Gemma recognized the technique. Every so often her father hid behind words, too. Not big words, but acronyms, military slang, a patter she could never understand. But she knew what Saperstein was saying, and no amount of fancy vocabulary could make it any less horrible.
You're going to kill them, she said. Though it was what she'd been expecting, it was terrible to say the words out loud. The room seemed suddenly to be filling with fog. Or maybe it was her head that was filling up. She couldn't make his face come into focus.
What about me? Are you going to kill me, too?
Kill you?
He actually laughed.
Last time I checked, that was still illegal in this country. I'm going to make some calls and sort out some details and get you home to your father. Then I'm going to hope he doesn't kill me.
He didn't sound like he was lying. What about Pete? She asked. She thought, though she couldn't be sure, that for a split second he froze, and a sour panic rose in her throat. If you don't let him go, I'll tell everyone. My dad will track you down and murder you.
Gemma, please. Of course Pete will go home.
If he'd hesitated before, now he spoke easily.
I know you think I'm some kind of monster, but I'm not. I'm a geek from Bethesda, Maryland, who fell in love with science and has loved it my whole life. I have a cat at home. Did you know that? He's a 13-year-old tub named Copernicus. Copper, for short. I'm a Dodgers fan, God help me.
Could she have been wrong about Dr. Saperstein? Was it possible that Haven's work was, if not right, then at least justified? The idea made her head hurt. But what you've done is monstrous, she said. What you're talking about doing is monstrous. It's murder.
It's euthanasia, he said a little more forcefully. And it's standard practice. Labs all across the world do chemical testing on live animals. Cancer researchers inject rats with cancer cells. Ebola researchers shoot monkeys up with Ebola. Test subjects are routinely euthanized.
But we're not talking about rats, she said, or monkeys. She thought of strange calliope and her enormous eyes. Gemma's color exactly, only bigger in her thin face. She thought of the girl who'd nearly stabbed her with a syringe, and the children who spent their days crawling around in oversized diapers, sucking their fingers and wailing if a nurse tried to touch them. How many graves would they need? Would they even be buried? Lyra had mentioned that the replicas at Haven were either buried or packaged up and dumped into the ocean. But there were no oceans here. Perhaps they would be stacked like fish fillets in refrigerated trucks and shipped off to the coast. We're talking about people. Human beings. Saperstein squinted at her as if trying to see her from a distance.
You're what? 16, 17? I remember being your age. Everything seems so certain. Black and white. Wrong and right. Good guys and bad guys. But the real world isn't like that, unfortunately.
He leaned forward again, putting his elbows on the desk. His sweater, Gemma saw, was in fact filmy with a surface of cat hair, and it made her want to cry again.
Let me ask you something. What makes a human? Do you think it's our eyes, our ears, our capacity to walk upright?
She nearly said, all of those things. When he went on,
it can't be. What about the blind, or people missing their ears, or paralyzed from the shoulders down? What about people whose faces have been burned off, deformed by war or birth? You would say that those people are humans, too, wouldn't you?
Of course, Gemma said quickly, embarrassed she had been on the verge of agreeing to something so stupid. Being human isn't a trait, like having hair.
Okay, so what is it?
That's a dumb question. But she realized she couldn't actually answer him. It's how we think, she said finally. It's our brains and what we do with them.
But what about humans who've lost their capacity to think and reason?
He asked. He sounded almost apologetic, as if he hadn't meant to trap her.
And what about computers? Which can think and reason as well as any human. Are they people? Do they deserve to have rights and freedoms?
You're trying to confuse me, Gemma said.
No, Gemma, I'm not. I'm trying to understand.
Dr. Saperstein sighed and took off his glasses. Suddenly he looked strangely exposed, like a half-blind mole coming up from the ground. There was a splotchy ink stain on his cheek, and more on his fingers.
If it isn't legs or eyes or even how we think, what? Might it be the capacity to love, to be loved, to grieve and be grieved for by others? Friendship, connection, the ability to empathize, to walk in someone else's shoes?
She could see now why he had been the one to take over after Dr. Haven's death. Why people had trusted him to lead. His voice was hypnotic, almost comforting, like the drumming of rain on a window. He wanted to curl up and go to sleep, let his voice do all the work. "You're talking about a soul," she said. Suddenly she was exhausted. She remembered all at once being at church when she was a kid, leaning against her mom, drowsy in the sunlight, while the priest droned on and on.
Soul, sure. It doesn't really matter what you call it.
Saperstein was still watching her. She felt he almost knew what she was thinking. He spoke so softly she nearly missed what he said next.
Whatever it is, the replicas don't have it.
So what? That gives you the right to use them how you want? When had they stopped going to church? And why? It seemed important, suddenly, to know. Had her parents believed, like the replicas did, that because she wasn't made by God, she didn't belong to him? That she was excluded? What about the Home Foundation? You stole kids, and you can't pretend they weren't loved by someone, somewhere. You can't pretend they aren't people. For the first time, Dr. Saperstein looked uncomfortable. And this, more than anything, gave her a small jolt of pleasure. She sat up a little straighter. You didn't think I knew about that? She thought of poor Rick Harless, his stale breath and face rutted by years of desperation and loss. That shitty motel room when he'd first told her about how she'd been born, made, at Haven.
What happened at the Home Foundation was wrong, he said firmly.
Once again, she was surprised.
You have to understand. I had no idea what was happening until later. We were on the verge of shutting down. I was on a plane 20-25 hours a week, in different states and even different countries, trying to raise funds. I trusted the wrong people to manage. And believe me, I put an end to it as soon as I found out.
Was it possible? In a letter Emily Huang had written to her friend, she'd made it sound as if it was all Dr. Saperstein's idea. But what if she'd lied? What if she was ashamed of her own role? What if she had killed herself after all, out of guilt and shame and a sense of remorse? You covered it up, Gemma said. You lied and you made everybody else lie too.
What else was I supposed to do? We would have lost everything. Then there would have been no reason for any of it.
He leaned forward and his eyes screwed onto hers like metal caps.
We're talking about research that directly impacts Alzheimer's research. Research into what makes the brain deteriorate. How to stop it. We're talking about research that could have spared the lives of thousands of civilians stuck in hellish war zones. That might have been used in targeted attacks to prevent the horrific casualties of innocent people. We're talking about research critical to modern food supply. I regret some of the things we did. And some of the things done in our name. Of course I do. But we were fighting a countrywide campaign against reason. Against research.
That still doesn't give you the right, Gemma said. He ducked his head and sat for a few seconds with his eyes closed, almost as if he were praying. When he raised his head again, he looked even older, as if several years had elapsed.
Do you use shampoo?
She was so startled by the question she couldn't even nod. He went on anyway.
Do you take cold medicine when you're sick or Advil when you have a headache? How about vaccinations? Been vaccinated for mumps, rubella, tetanus? Vaccinations are diseases, you know. They are nothing more than weak concentrations of the exact disease they are designed to prevent.
What's your point? She felt shaky, almost dizzy, as if she'd stood up too quickly, although she was still sitting across from him.
How do you think those drugs came to market? How did the Advil get into your bathroom cabinet? How did the Sudafed land on your bedside table? How did we cure polio, tuberculosis, smallpox? How did we save hundreds of thousands of people, millions of people, from diseases big and small?
His smile was thinning.
Hundreds of thousands of mice, rabbits, primates, killed. Humans too, of course. Volunteers, desperate people, sick people. Some of them dead because of side effects, unpredictable responses, bad science or just bad luck. I'm one of only thousands of scientists and researchers doing similar work, dangerous work. Work that requires living people to die, so that in the future people can keep living. A terrible paradox. But there you go. Did you know that a former staff member of mine is up and running in Allentown, Pennsylvania? All our funding will go to her, and the cycle continues.
The name registered dimly in Gemma's memory, but she didn't know why. Saperstein wasn't done.
And those are just the medical casualties. Noble, really, by comparison to what we do every day,
in thousands of places across the globe, all for cheaper products and more of them, new clothes every season, new cell phones, faster cars.
That's different, Gemma said, but she couldn't think how.
Is it?
He shook his head.
I don't think so. Everything we have, everything we know, everything we own has been paid for in someone's blood. Once you understand that, you understand we're just talking about ratios, percentages, math.
He was confusing her, like our father always did, twisting things around somehow.
How many people have to benefit from a cure before you risk the life of a single test patient? 10. 100. How many people might live easier lives because of a new technology before you can justify disrupting the livelihoods of those who benefit from the old one? What does help have to look like? Do you have to help them a little or a lot? Help them now or in the future? Tell me. If you have the formula figured out, tell me.
Of course she couldn't. There was no answer. She didn't know.
What about all those children who work back-breaking hours for pennies at factories across the globe to make the t-shirts you and your friends wear, who die early of tumors caused by fumes, smog, chemicals? How about boys sold into slavery on fishing boats to haul smelt and plankton so that we can eat fresh shrimp all year round? How about girls half your age helping to make your shoes, your lip gloss, your phone covers, your accessories? What about children blown up mining minerals we use for the memory chips in your cell phone, and children eviscerated by drone strikes in countries we spent decades squeezing for their oil, whole countries decimated, populations starving to death slowly? What about them? Who's crying for them?
Gemma was crying. She couldn't help it.
We never cloned people at Haven. That's what you have to understand. That's impossible and always will be. We cloned genetic composition, fetal cells, structure.
Gemma could tell by how easily and quickly the words came, how often he had repeated them to himself. She could tell he really believed them.
You can't make people with science. We're all born a collection of cells and senses and chemical patterns. We have to become human.
Gemma thought of Calliope, and the bulwark of her ribs beneath her skin, the way her hand, slick with sweat, had held to Gemma's so tightly. A terrible sadness touched her.
The replicas can't feel loss or love or empathy. When they die, no one grieves for them, and they grieve for no one else. Any one of them would kill you or me if it suited them, if they needed to. Anyone would lie or cheat or rob you and never feel bad about it. They wouldn't even know the difference. To them, there is surviving and not surviving. And that's it.
Was any of it true? Did it even matter? You make them sound like robots, she said.
Not robots, he said.
And for a brief second, a look of terror moved like a hard storm across his face.
Animals.
Lyra, 14. His name was Sebastian, and with his help, they elbowed their way free of the crowd. From a distance, it resembled an organic mass, a seething, hungry creature. Lyra was still having trouble breathing. She kept scanning the street for the man with the fish eyes or the woman who traveled with him. She felt the weight of invisible observers watching their progress, the way she had always felt the glass eyes at Haven. Animals, Sebastian said again when they were several blocks away and the noise of the chanting had faded. Lyra was surprised that it was still early afternoon, still sunny, that the cars still churned by slowly, that nothing else had stopped. Selim hadn't spoken at all. His left eye was swollen shut. When he leaned over and spat up a gob of blood, the boy shook his head. You should really get some ice on that. And clean the cut, too, so it doesn't get infected. I'm in med school, he added, in response to a look from Lyra. If you want, my apartment's right around the corner. Lyra hadn't exactly recognized it as an invitation until he started walking again, and Selim, to her surprise, followed. Sebastian lived in a small, bright apartment on the third floor above a sandwich shop. The whole place smelled like the inside of a book. Books sagged in the built-in shelves lining the wall. The sun caught thick swaths of dust in the air and striped the room vividly in golden light. She couldn't see anything in the haze of sun. "My roommate's a lit PhD student," Sebastian said when he caught Lyra pacing the shelves, running her fingers over the spines. "Can you believe he still reads paper books? It's so 19th century." The sun made black spots in Lyra's vision. The room began to turn slowly, and to stay standing, she had to grip the table. Side effects? No. Symptoms. "Do you have a bathroom?" she asked him. Sebastian had so many things it made her dizzy. Paperclips and mugs, framed photographs and bundles of wire, coins and little porcelain trays to hold them. She could hear all of it screaming, crying out in neglect. She wanted to open her mouth and swallow the whole room. She wished she could stuff all of his belongings down inside her like some kind of magical potion that would turn her human, totally human, at last. Like some kind of magical potion that could make her well. "Are you all right?" He squinted at her, and for the first time she noticed how nice his clothing was compared to theirs, how well it fit him, how healthy he looked. "Bathroom?" she managed to say again, even as she felt bile biting off the edge of the word, making acid in her throat. In the bathroom, she turned on the faucets and opened her mouth and let the black come up. Waves of sickness that brought with them a sharp antiseptic burn in her throat and Haven's smell. They had failed to find Dr. Saperstein, like they had failed to save Rick Harless or Jake Witz or Cassiopeia in the marshes. Everywhere they went, they had left nothing but death behind them. And she had nothing but death to look forward to. She sat back on her heels, waiting for the rise and fall of the room to go still. Her face was wet. She was crying. A green toothbrush with its bristles splayed, tweezers, a scattering of clipped hair, an empty tissue box gathering dust, a straw basket piled with magazines and paperback books. She wanted things. She wanted a phone, an apartment full of books, tall glasses and ice cube trays and mugs for tea hanging from nails beneath the kitchen cabinets. She wanted a space she could fill and fill with her belongings until no one could touch her, no one could even reach her past all of her beautiful things. She took a paperback from the basket and opened to inhale its pages. She tore off a piece of paper and then another and fed the pieces one by one into her mouth until she felt well enough to stand. She hadn't brought her backpack to the bathroom, and that was a mistake. But she tucked the paper back into her waistband and found her t-shirt concealed it perfectly. She washed her mouth out. She felt better, with those pieces of paper pulsing their small words out from somewhere deep in her chest. Hers. Selim and Sebastian had moved into the kitchen.
"I should have known the whole demonstration would be a disaster," Sebastian was saying. Without his glasses, he was beautiful. Not as beautiful as Selim, but still beautiful. He had dark skin, high cheekbones, and eyes the same color as the afternoon sunlight on the wood floor. "But people never listen to reason. They don't care about facts. They read one think piece in the Times, and they get hysterical about everything. I swear you can't even fart on this campus without someone screaming environmental policy at you nowadays. Do you want some water or something? Beer? I have wine, but it's old."
"Water's fine," Lyra and Selim said at the same time.
"I'm not a conservative," Sebastian said. He poured water from the tap into tall glasses, and Lyra marveled at how comfortable he was touching everything, as if the whole space was just an extension of his body. "I understand we shouldn't have theaters named after Ponzi scheme billionaires or slave owners, and in our country, that excludes more people than you'd think. But Richard Haven?" He shook his head. "His work on stem cell regeneration was pioneering. Do you know he built a lab in his room when he was in elementary school? He isolated his first nucleus when he was 9, using a kitchen spatula, basically. I'm exaggerating, but you get the point. He was a genius. You think Steve Jobs made people feel warm and fuzzy? Benjamin Franklin was a total prick, and so was Edison. He bought the idea for the light bulb, by the way. He was basically just the licensor. He paused to take a breath, and Lyra, too, felt breathless. So many words, ideas, names she'd never heard. And she realized then that that was what being raised at Haven truly meant, and why she would never be entirely human. It wasn't that they'd inserted needles to draw bone marrow, or fed her a diet of pills, that they'd called her it, that she had never been held or cuddled, that her head had been shaved to keep out lice, and small, fatal disease cells had been introduced into her muscle tissue just to watch what would happen. She'd been completely torn away from the human timeline, from a vast history of events, achievements, and names spanning more years than she could think of. She had no context. She was a word on a blank page. There was no way to read meaning into it. No wonder she felt so alone. Actually, that was one of the reasons I was hoping that Dr. Saperstein would show up today. Other than taking a stand, I mean. I'm interested in medical tech, and I'm curious about the IP aspect. They're saying Cat O'Donnell might be up for a Nobel Prize. But she wouldn't have a career if it weren't for Haven. The whole idea of individual-specific stem cell regeneration, it seems obvious now, but that was a revolutionary idea. The name O'Donnell touched Lyra like the electric zap of the extraordinary kissable graph. One of the machines she'd loved the best at Haven, which read her heartbeats and then drew them vividly in climbing green lines and vivid peaks that recalled the mountains she'd seen only on TV. You know Dr. O'Donnell? She asked. I mean, not personally. Sebastian gave her a look she didn't know how to decipher. I just know her because of what she's doing at K6. I heard she used to work with Dr. Saperstein at Haven. He added almost as an afterthought. That's why he's suing her. I guess he thinks she stole some of his research. Meanwhile, O'Donnell won't say a word about it. Still, pictures never lie. He pulled out his cell phone and made adjustments to it, tapping and swiping the screen. Then he spun it across the table to her and she lost her breath. There, in miniature, was Dr. O'Donnell, stepping off one of the trash ferries that used to travel back and forth to Haven. She was wearing regular clothing, and her head was angled toward Dr. Saperstein, who was next to her. But Lyra would have known her just from the geometry of her ear, where it joined her jaw, by the color of her hair, by the way her mouth flattened when she thought. Dr. O'Donnell had given them names from the stars, and so she had given them a whole universe. And in a single instant, Lyra realized how wrong she had been, how stupid. Dr. Saperstein wasn't God. Dr. O'Donnell was.
Gemma. 15. There were different soldiers on duty outside the bathrooms that night. A young man and woman, maybe early 20s. The card table was gone. It must have been packed up and shipped off. Gemma had lost count of how many vans had left throughout the day. Though the airport was still crowded with clutter, medical equipment, and mattresses, curtained-off alcoves and makeshift break stations, it felt incalculably emptier. It felt like being sunk at the center of an old ship while it was hollowed out by bottom-feeding fish. The rain, still drumming the windows, filled the terminal with hollow echoes. As soon as the female soldier saw them approaching, she stood up abruptly and vanished, as though by prearranged signal. The guy was older, maybe 24 or 25, with a blunt jaw and a prominent forehead that made his eyes appear to be hiding out in his face. "That's Wayne," Calliope said. She had taken Gemma's hand again, and Gemma was both glad of and frightened by her grip. "Wayne was the one who told me about Pinocchio and how he got spitted up by the whale." A strange expression pulled briefly at Calliope's face. If Gemma hadn't known better, she would have called it joy. They had to wait for Wayne, an ugly name, she'd always thought, made even uglier now by him, to acknowledge them. Calliope didn't tense up or even seem uncomfortable when he stared baldly at her breasts and legs, at the space between her legs. She was used to it, Gemma knew, and that was the most terrible thing of all. Her body had never belonged to her, not for a second. Animals, Dr. Saperstein had said. But animals had the urge to protect themselves, to protect one another. The replicas were like human photonegatives, like they weren't alive at all, only giving the impression of it, but always just a little bit off. Even tonight, moving through the darkened puzzle of bodies, Gemma had the strangest feeling that none of the replicas were sleeping at all. That this, too, was illusion, bodies laid down to rest while their spirits roamed elsewhere, hungry and awake.
"All right," Wayne said finally. "But quick. 15 minutes.
As soon as they started toward the bathroom together, he called them back.
"See me after,"
he said to Calliope. Gemma was surprised and relieved to find Pete already waiting for her, leaning heavily on the counter, head bowed. For a second, she hung back. His face was so serious, so sad, it made her ache. But when he caught sight of her, his face rearranged into the one she knew so well, and it was like two plates slid together deep inside her and sealed off a rift. Her anger went, and so did her fear. If she could just stay with him, everything would be fine. She was grateful that Calliope let her go, and even hung back when Pete hugged her and kissed her gently, lips, nose, forehead, and lips again. It was funny. As soon as Pete had become her boyfriend, she had started being more careful about her looks, not less. She put on lip gloss and mascara. She always made sure her hair was blown straight. She agonized about what she wore. She told herself she wanted him to be proud of her, but it wasn't that, not exactly. Really, she wanted to make sure he wasn't embarrassed. But here, in this place, even though she hadn't showered, a ritual that, like laundry day, occurred once a week, in which replicas were shuffled in and out by the dozen to hose off in a dim concrete room with open holes for drainage. Even though the toothbrush she'd been given had disappeared earlier that morning, even though she was braless, her breasts sticky heavy beneath her shirt, she realized it didn't matter at all. She loved him and felt in that moment truly loved. The feeling of being saved, of coming home after a long night at a terrible party, and getting to wipe your makeup off and take off uncomfortable tights and slip into a pair of worn pajamas.
"Another day in paradise, huh?"
Pete said, touching her face. She could feel Calliope watching them, and was struck by Calliope's stillness, her complete absorption. She was reminded, then, of the way her cats, Bean and Ender, sat in the window seat to watch the geese that landed on her lawn on their way south. It was as if Calliope's whole body was funneled into her eyes and the desire to consume. She was going crazy. She was going to lose her mind in this place.
"You okay?"
he asked. She tried to smile but saw her reflection thrown back at her, ghastly.
"I'm okay," she said. "I saw Dr. Saperstein today."
She lowered her voice, hooked her fingers into the neck of her T-shirt. Hers, familiar, real. "It's all over. They're shutting down."
"Yeah, I kind of got the idea. I'm surprised they haven't shipped out the toilets yet."
Then, unexpectedly,
"Three replicas died today. I saw them packed up. They were loaded onto a gurney like meat or something. All bundled in plastic."
His voice was too tight, like fabric stretched thin by too much use.
"There are children tied down in place. One of the nurses said that otherwise they'll try and chew their own fingers or scratch themselves until they bleed." "And the nurses?"
Finally, the fabric snapped. His voice cracked.
"Nurses, doctors, soldiers, everyday people, good people. It's like they've all gone blind. It's like this place has blinded them. How can they stand it?"
"Pete." She couldn't make it better. She couldn't explain. There was no explanation. They had to get out of here before they were poisoned. She took his hands. They were very cold.
Pete, listen to me. Dr. Saperstein is making arrangements with my dad, Gemma said quietly. He's going to let us go. His eyes were like windows, suddenly shuttered. She was aware of a strange tension, not just here but everywhere, as if an enormous underground rift was slowly widening, as if they might all drop. We don't have a choice, she added. She seemed to smell smoke. Memories that weren't even hers flowed to her, of Haven on fire, of the island burning and bodies bleeding out into the marsh. Maybe Calliope wasn't feeding off her. Maybe she was feeding from Calliope, collapsing into her. But the important thing is that we're getting out of here. They're letting us go. He looked away. A muscle pulsed in and out in his jaw.
When? He said finally.
Tomorrow? Still, he wouldn't look at her. She followed his gaze and saw that he was staring at Calliope in the mirror. But she wasn't looking back at him. She was standing motionless, staring up at the ceiling with the strangest smile on her face, as if she was listening to a favorite song played far away. I don't know when. I think Dr. Saperstein's scared. He'll have to... negotiate, she nearly said, but stopped. The word wouldn't make it out beyond a sudden tightness, a feeling of burning.
I won't go, Pete said. I can't.
And she heard the crack of the fault line beneath her feet. She saw that they were already falling. You can't save them, she said, but she felt a rising panic as the dark rose up to reach them. She heard her own voice faintly and heard, too, the echo of Dr. Saperstein. It's already done.
I can't just walk out of here.
He turned back to her, but now she hardly recognized him. His eyes didn't seem brown so much as gray. Smoke gray.
I can't just forget.
I'm not asking you to forget, she said. She realized she was going to cry and had to swallow fast. But there's no other choice.
There is, he said sharply. There always is. There has to be.
Would you rather stay here? She was cold and hot all at once. She was losing him. What about your parents? What about how worried they must be? Pete stepped away from her.
So that's it? We leave, and your dad's the big hero.
He looked so different when he frowned, older and harder somehow. She'd nearly always seen him smiling, had even begun to believe it was his natural state, like having blonde hair or freckles like a scattering of brown sugar.
And then what? We go back to school? We hold hands after chem and I drive you home and fill you up in your driveway and that's it? That's all we have? That's all...
He broke off, as if the words had driven the air from his lungs on the way out.
Sorry,
he said in a different tone of voice, and turning back, tried to put his hands on her shoulders.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean that.
Don't, she said. If he touched her, her skin would burn away. She would disappear into smoke. All along she'd been wrong. All along he had been ashamed of her. Ashamed and disappointed, and trying to hide it only because she was the best he could do right now.
Gemma, please. That came out all wrong.
He looked truly upset, but she didn't care. Didn't feel sorry for him at all.
You know, I didn't mean...
When again she stepped away from him, he let his hand hover there for a second.
What I meant was, I can't go back. I can't just rewind. Do you understand?
His voice was climbing registers, clawing up toward a point of panic. She saw him bloated by misery, choking on its fumes.
I can't unsee what I've seen. I can't unknow what I know. I can't.
Keep your voice down, she said. Something really was burning. She wasn't imagining it. She could smell smoke now, for sure. Confusedly, she thought Calliope must be smoking. But that was crazy. Calliope was still smiling her secret smile, still absorbed in her own invisible kingdom. And besides, the smell was too strong for that. Pete hadn't heard or didn't care.
He was talking louder than ever, as if he weren't so much speaking the words as letting them rattle through him.
I can't walk out of here and know that these people, people, Gemma, not experiments, not test subjects, human beings, are going to die.
But then he broke off again, and she knew that he, too, had felt the change, the approach of danger that, like a storm, sent invisible messages ahead.